In order to understand who the Shiites are, what the divisions within Islam are, just as you're familiar with, if you try to give a short explanation of the divisions within Christianity without getting into some of the history of Christianity, it would be impossible. And so it is in terms of talking with Islam. I want to put this, though, in a context of some of the themes that I see in Islamic history and how these sectarian divisions have played off against the theme, particularly the theme of unity and the desire for unity, and how the opposite kinds of things that have happened have been dealt with then. I guess we're about ready to roll the tape. This is then Paul Hansen speaking on sectarian conflict within Islam, specifically about Shiism. I think when we talked last night, those of you who were here last night, we talked about the images that Islam projects in the world, and particularly for the last decade, how those images have particularly been colored by Ayatollah Khomeini and the revolution in Iran. And if it's not the revolution in Iran, it's Lebanon and the Marines bombing incident there, or the kidnapping of hostages there. All of these most publicized events for which you came forth with the proper code words as encapsulated by the media, fanatical, martyrs, etc., are manifestations in particular of people who proclaim themselves to be Shiite Muslims. And in fact, I think you would have been hard-pressed before the Iranian Revolution to get anybody in the Western media to even make a distinction among any kind of Muslims, much less a Shiite or a Sunni or any other type. Just they were all Muslims. But now somehow there's a vague distinction out there that there is a different group known as Shiites, and boy, they seem to be the really wild ones. What are these people up to? They seem to be willing to kill themselves with car bombs and commit any kind of atrocity. What's with these people? I assume that's why perhaps some of you are there, to get the quick and dirty answer to this. I'm not sure I'm not going to be able to supply it in the 55 minutes that we have, but we'll give it a shot. As I said, as I thought about discussing this topic, it seemed to me there was no avoiding the history. As Carol Brooklyn was talking about the Arab-Israeli conflict in Palestine, these are people, and the Shiites in particular, are people who live very close to their histories. And some of the events that I'm going to talk about that happened in the 7th century are still the pivotal events as far as Shiites are concerned, and you have to be aware of them to understand how they're relating to not only their own history, but how they're then bringing that forward with them into the 20th century. As I said, I want to speak about this primarily in juxtaposition with the theme for unity, which is, as I see it, is a central theme in Islamic history that goes right back to the very beginnings of Islam itself. If that is a central theme in Islamic history, the desire for unity and a unified community, then certainly that any threats to that unity are, by definition, crisis situations within the community. At times, this has inevitably resulted in conflict and some division, but in other times, in the name of unity, many kinds of compromises have been made in the Islamic culture and civilization, which in some ways has allowed it to spread into so many different cultural areas. When I say that this was a concern from the beginning, one of the things that characterizes Islamic unity, again a cliche that again is fairly widely known, is that there is no distinction between church and state in Islam. That this is a again, the cliche would have it, Islam is a way of life, not just a religion. That everything that you do has some sort of religious significance and is measured in that way. Part of the reason for that goes back to the origins of Islam. And without trying to get bogged down too much in it, I think I need to give you a little capsule version of that in order for you to understand what Islam what needs Islam met at the time. If we look at Arabia before Islam, Arabia in the 6th century, we have an area, I'll throw the map up here just for people to glance at just as a refresher here. We have a map, we have a peninsula here, which had no real state, no organized political authority. The inhabitants of most of Arabia were Bedouin clans and tribes. Arabia, before people knew they were floating on a sea of oil, of course, offered very little in the way of inducements to be able
kind of rational
calculation. You never know.
We'll
keep going, inshallah. Yes. Arabia then could support a relatively small population, and in fact, in much of the interior of Arabia, it was impossible to support any kind of population before the domestication of the camel. The water sources in Arabia are not only few and far between, but they're of two different types. Some are large enough to be able to sustain oasis agriculture. There are certain cities, in other words, where you can see the date palms, but even a few more things and so forth around. You could do a little irrigation out of it. Other places, though, have only enough water to be occasionally used by flocks and herds as they come through and come by. The Bedouin, who were camel nomads and also kept other animals, as I say, were constantly fighting in their clan and tribal divisions over the relatively scarce resources of pasturage, water, etc. Because the precarious means of subsistence were so much in the balance, it was accepted that raiding against other clans and tribes was a perfectly legitimate way of supplementing one's income and increasing the power and status of the clan. But with no organized political authority above, the inevitable result of raiding was the institution of blood feud. How do you can't appeal to the state, you can't appeal to the authorities to avenge a wrong that has been done, and so an ethos developed among the Bedouin that honor, bravery, courage, things that were Bedouin virtues, also reinforced the military capabilities of the tribe, but then were collectively applied to the clan as a whole. So that if my brother were killed in a raid by a neighboring tribe, I was honor-bound to avenge my brother, but not necessarily by finding the person from that tribe who had killed my brother, but killing simply a member of that clan or tribe that did so. An eye for an eye, a life for a life, but with the corporate group, not individual responsibility. Corporate group, which of course results in inevitable retaliation by his relatives coming back to my clan. And so what you have with blood feuds, the old Hatfield and McCoy thing, is that it continues indefinitely. Now, this creates a very precarious situation. One of the ways in which Bedouin society dealt with this was to develop an ethos of hospitality in the desert, where individual travelers were allowed some kind of shelter, regardless. But by and large, you could expect, if you happen with a few of your flocks and herds or a few members of your family to be wandering in the desert and to be met by someone hostile, to have to defend yourself and perhaps be killed. The social political problems that were engendered by this kind of system are quite evident. It was an insecure existence for everybody. Now, in the 6th century, one of the things that began to happen at an oasis called Mecca, which you see up there in the map, was that they began to profit exceedingly from the diversion of trade that used to go up the Persian Gulf or down the Red Sea, primarily because conditions in those areas have become very volatile and insecure. And if there's one thing that merchants want, it's some kind of security for the routes passing through. Now, Mecca was then able to profit from this because of pirates in the Black Sea and the fact that the Byzantine Empire and the Sasanian Empire, which were the Persians, were fighting in the Mesopotamian region. But if they were to profit from this, they would need to develop security from the raids of the Bedouin tribes passing through. After all, merchants aren't going to come through if these clans who believe that raiding is just the thing for supplementing the income are going to start preying on the caravans as well. Now, what happened in Mecca then, before the time of Muhammad, was that the Bedouin clans and tribes were invited to bring into Mecca to a place called the Kaaba, a sanctuary, which held, among other things, a black meteorite, a stone, which was revered by local Arabs as a sacred object. And in fact, one of the common beliefs among pre-Islamic Bedouins was what's called litholatry, worship of stones, other kinds of objects that were able to hold individualized spirits. Well, often many clans and tribes had their own separate images, and they were encouraged to bring these images into the Kaaba and make it a general sanctuary for themselves, and then to celebrate annually or on a regular basis religious festivals with all of these images. What that did with Mecca is create a holy place for the surrounding Arab clans and tribes, and as a result, in a holy place, no blood could be shed, and therefore you were safe from any enemies that you could meet, even though there were all a gathering of different clans and tribes would come in. You couldn't defile a holy place with murder. Nobody was going to slip a knife between your ribs while you were trading in Mecca because it was a holy place. You extended the system, as the Meccan authorities did, by setting aside certain months of the year, which would be for pilgrimage to Mecca, and then the caravans could move safely outside because they were under Meccan protection as well. And this all, this religious system, in other words, that was set up in Mecca, was the key to their economic prosperity. They were the kind of general holy land shrine there for pre-Islamic Bedouins. Now, Muhammad then grew up in Mecca. A member of a clan that was not in the top rank of Meccan material prosperity, which had a very noble lineage. Now, one of the things that all this new wealth did to Mecca, as often happens in any nouveau riche society, is that it begins to break down old tribal values. And among the values were the group solidarity aspects in which resources were widely shared among members of the tribe, widows and orphans who were left destitute by raiding, for example, their men being killed off would always have been taken care of by other tribal and kin members. But once you create a capitalist society where capital is needed to participate in the caravan trade, then you don't want to distribute this stuff, or redistribute it, I should say. Instead, individual families want to have money so they can make more money. And you get the gaps growing between rich and poor as opposed to a rather egalitarian Bedouin society before. Muhammad grew up in this environment in which then there was a weakening of the clan and tribal obligations within Mecca. In other words, again, a breaking down of unity. And also the Bedouins in the surrounding area were still plagued with the problems of blood feud, which was another problem of unity for the Arabs. Okay, that as background. When Muhammad began to preach, he didn't meet a great reception in Mecca. And perhaps now you can figure out why. Because among the things that he was preaching was, of course, there was but one God. All these other gods were false gods. And the Meccan authorities could see the dollar signs just drifting away. If somebody came in here, cleansed out the whole Kaaba out of all these idols that are there, well, there goes the business. And so he had a difficult time, not only attracting converts, but also protecting the converts that he got. Fortunately, his own clan and tribal members did protect him, and his uncle happened to be the chief of the clan at the time, and so nothing too bad happened to them. But it was tough sledding for the first decade or so while Muhammad was trying to preach these things, these revelations that he was getting. The turning point for Islam came in the year 622. Now, it's very interesting that both Islam, Judaism as well, we should say, and Christianity, they're all historically oriented religions. They have a linear sense of time. They believe time began at a certain moment, is proceeding in a linear fashion toward a apocalyptic end, a day of judgment, and therefore their view of history is one in which they're very acutely aware of the passage between these two events. So they're historically oriented. Now, how do they organize history? How do Christians organize history? What year is this? What was the most important event in history as far as Christians were concerned? Well, it was the incarnation. Therefore, everything along this line is divided as either on one side or the other side of that line. Now, you get a good insight into Islam to understand the Islamic calendar. Which date do they pick for dividing everything in history as either before or after? 622 is the date. Now, is that the date of Muhammad's birth? No. Is that the date of Muhammad's death? No. Is that the date of Muhammad's first revelation and his beginning to preach? No. What is it the date of? It's the date of what is called the Hijra. Well, the first of several words will flow up here. It can be spelled in various ways, but because of the transliteration from Arabic, I guess we're going to wind up with dry pens, but H-I-J-R-A, Hijra. Often you'll find it translated in English works as the flight, but it really probably is better translated as the migration. Migration from where to where? Well, from Mecca to a city which is not on this map, unfortunately, but which is north of Mecca here, called, as it came to be called anyway, you'll find it on maps today, Medina. The immigration, the flight to Medina. And so in the Muslim calendar, you'll find the year is something like 1407 AH, after the Hijra. Why is that so important? Let me get back to my theme again. The reason is because when Muhammad and his small band of converts accepted the invitation by people in Medina to come up to Medina because they needed a mediator. They had a blood feud that had broken out in Medina itself. And Medina was an agricultural oasis. It's one thing if you're a Bedouin and floating around the desert. You can be in a blood feud and maybe not see your neighbor, but once you have a blood feud breaking out in an agricultural oasis, it's got to be settled. And they brought him in as a mediator because in their various journeys to Mecca for the religious festivals, they had recognized him as an upright man and also as someone who was not likely to be a Trojan horse for the Meccans because he was on the outs there and he may be willing to come. Well, when he goes with his followers, he does one very important thing, which is that he cuts off all the ties that he and his followers have with their clan, tribe, and family in Mecca. They no longer have the protection of those people. And that's the whole basis of the socio-political system there. They now form a new community. A new community that is based not on blood, but on shared belief and conduct. And they are going to be able to form a new basis for a community now on those criteria. So what the Hijra really means then is it's the beginning of the Ummah. Well, boy, let's try another marker. Maybe we'll try a different color here, huh? Yeah, this is a little better. Maybe not, but one letter. U-M-M-A, Ummah. It means community. And that's what is really significant about the year 622. It's a new community formed on the basis of shared belief and shared conduct as opposed to blood, which was the whole basis of Arabian society before that time. Well, I don't have time, and you probably don't have the interest to go into all the things that happened since that time, but it also marks an interesting division, roughly, in the material that's in the Quran. Muhammad began to receive revelations about 610 when he was 40. He went through his midlife crisis and, you know, had that. About 40 is when a lot of us, you know, somehow start hearing things, maybe. I don't want to make too much light of it. But the point is that Muhammad, in his early revelations, was given more doctrinal positions to speak about. And so it was the beliefs that he was speaking about to the Meccans. But once he got to Medina, the later revelations begin to deal more with the organization of the community and how conduct should be regulated among this new community that's formed. And so if you ever get a hold of a copy of the Quran is arranged in a rather strange way. It's from the shortest revelations to the longest. And by and large, or I should say reverse, and by and large, the newer revelations are in the front, and the older revelations are in the back. But in any case, the concentration here on creating a unified lifestyle, unified conduct for the community became the preoccupation in Medina. At the same time, of course, though, they had to find a way of earning a living. It was an agricultural oasis away from the trade routes. All the land was taken. And almost of necessity, then, they turned to raiding as a way of supporting themselves. Now, who did they raid? Well, they raided the Meccan caravans, even during these sacred months of the truce, because, after all, the Meccans had had their chance. They had heard the message. They'd refused to believe it. And Muhammad and his followers were not bound by the kind of sacred taboos that were associated with this protection. They didn't fear any curses from the gods for violating this. And when these raids turned out to be successful, many other Arab tribes began to think of two things. One is maybe there's something to what this guy is saying, because even though he flouts the sacred taboos, nothing bad is happening to them. Instead, they're getting stronger. And after all, if they're getting rich on this, why shouldn't we? And they began to join in large numbers. Within a number of years, in fact, within 8 years, Muhammad was strong enough to be able to go with his whole army back to Mecca. And when the Meccans looked out and saw him in 630 there, they said, "You win." They didn't even put up any resistance. He was allowed to come into the city, cleanse the Kaaba of idols, rededicate it to the worship only of Allah. And when he died then 2 years later, in 632, virtually all of the Arabian clans and tribes had been unified into this system, which, the point is here, was not just a system of belief now and conduct, but was a whole social political system as well. Here, Muhammad was the chief administrator, the chief judge in the community. It certainly had its economic aspects in that the goods and the plunder, or whatever you want to call it, that was collected on military campaigns was divided according to laws among all the community. And this was a community now that was potentially as big as the world, because you could be recruited to this community by accepting Islam, accepting the beliefs, and accepting the conduct code that went with it. Whereas before, there was no way in which you could join that other tribe. The only way you can be a member of a tribe is to be born into it. The blood is the only thing that unifies you. But now you have a system here which can unify all the Arabs. And because you're now a new community, a new type of tribe, as it were, based on blood and conduct, you don't kill members who are fellow members of the same tribe. Blood feuds are supposed to be ended now. Because now you're reorganized on a new basis. This I spent some time on because I think that the needs that Islam met are, as I say, were more than the religious ones. They were the social political needs of Arabia at the time, and that was one of the reasons why it was so spectacularly successful in its appeal. But it was also then a core part of what it meant to be Islamic was to be a member of this community. And to maintain the unity of that community. And therefore, as I say, when things maybe worked out so that that didn't happen, that was often a very, very traumatic thing for the community. Well, when Muhammad dies, 632, you're obviously in another crisis situation. What happens to this unity that he essentially created? When any successor, or what I should say, when any prophet or prophetic figure dies, that's always a very dangerous situation for his movement. 12 or 11 disciples huddled in an upper room. Christianity was maybe hanging on the balance there, depending upon how they reacted to Jesus' crucifixion. Probably we can find, and I can think of a few, historical examples of prophetic figures who were very big in their lifetime, but when they died, their movements died with them. So this is a crisis situation. What's going to happen? There are certainly two main issues that the community had to face. One was, how can people be assured that they are now going to be able to follow God's will? Muhammad had said that he was the last of the prophets, and he had received a continuous series of revelations during his lifetime, but now he was gone. Islam is not a religion that is grace-oriented. In fact, it's quite legalistic. The notion is that you are responsible for following God's commands and God's will, and it's up to you to do it. And at Judgment Day, you'll be weighed as to whether or not you have followed God's will. And these revelations had provided, along with Muhammad's guidance, the fleshing out of how one was to act. But clearly, any individual action had the potential to affect where you were sitting in the balance at Judgment Day. So you wanted that continual guidance to be able to understand what God's will would be, but now you don't have that immediacy of revelation. What's going to happen? I'll talk about what the answer to that was in a second, but let me get the second question on the floor here. The second question was, of course, who will guide the community and preserve it? Again, Muhammad left no specific instructions about what should happen as a successor to him. He said there wouldn't be any more prophets, but now we have more than simply a religious community. We have a socio-political entity here, a state, as it were, with an army, with administration, with bureaucracy that administers to the widows, the orphans, and others. Who's going to handle this? How's that going to be directed? Let me take it's the second question which becomes the basis of the movement of Shiism. So before I get to that, let me deal with the first one. How will people be assured that they are following God's will? Basically, this led to the development of the major currents in Muslim intellectual life, I should say. More Muslim intellectuals gravitated toward answering this question. And the way in which they did that was to develop what was called the Sharia. I'm probably going to give up writing on the board here, but the Sharia, which means literally the path, but is usually interpreted as the whole system of Islamic law. Again, the analogies are very clear with Judaism. You start with the Torah. The Torah provides a certain amount of guidance, but commentators and other learned people who study the Torah elaborate on it. We get the Mishnah, and then on the Mishnah, the Talmud, and so on, and you build up. Well, you begin, of course, with Islam, with the Quran. The Quran, after all, as we mentioned last time, was not anything written by Muhammad. It was believed by Muslims to be the literal word of God. The form in which God revealed himself here on earth was a book, the Quran. And so the most important thing was to get these revelations together, get them in a form which could be accurately transmitted. And in comparison, say, to the Christian scriptures, the Islamic Quran was put together much more rapidly after Muhammad's death than certainly after the death of Jesus. Probably the authoritative version of the Quran was in by about 20 years after Muhammad's death, a little more than that. That was the first thing to do. But if you've ever seen a copy of the Quran or a translation of the Quran is not a particularly large book, probably about the size of the New Testament. Certainly, it's not a very large book if it's going to be the sole guide to your behavior. You've got a question on what you're going to want to do. You look in the Quran, but what if the Quran doesn't have a revelation that's relevant to your particular question? What do you do next? So this became the preoccupation with the Muslim intellectual community, developing the Sharia, the path that would elaborate on the Quran. So you have as your first level of authority the Quran, but if there is anyone else to look to for guidance, it has to be Prophet Muhammad himself. Because surely he would have lived his life most in accordance with God's will. Now, he differentiated during his lifetime revelations from his own judgments. And people were aware when he was pronouncing a revelation as compared to when he was simply doing what he was doing. But people began to see the need immediately to collect stories, anecdotes about how Muhammad had reacted in this situation or that situation, what he had done in this one or that. And as these were compiled, these compilations of the custom of the early Islamic community. The custom, the word for custom is sunnah, S-U-N-N-A. And as these were compiled in reports called hadith, they became the second level of authority for the guidance of any individual Muslim. Finally, in the hadith, by the way, eventually get to be a very, very large shelf full of reports. And then, in fact, it had to be a whole spur to Islamic scholarship because people had to sort out the spurious hadiths from the genuine ones because, of course, an easy way to get something in, if you wanted, is to say, well, I remember when Muhammad said this, you know, and then people want to check that out and find out if it's really right. But in any case, it did get to be a voluminous amount of material. But again, there may be problems that wouldn't be covered in the authoritative hadith. Then the decision was made, again stressing the community here, that if God was no longer going to send prophets to his community, surely God would not allow his entire community to go astray. Individuals, sure, they might get off the path. But if there therefore was something that the entire community, by consensus, the word is ijma, by consensus agreed on was fitting and proper, and it was not contradictory with the Quran, first level of authority, hadith, second level, then it too must be lawful and in accordance with God's will, and so that becomes your third level of authority. Now, the problem with using consensus or ijma is that, of course, you build up a whole host of precedents for people to follow. The community then in 820 is doing what? Well, if it's doing something that the community in 820 believes is proper, that becomes a binding precedent for subsequent generations. And what happened with the buildup of the Islamic law, just as many Orthodox Jews would find, there are a lot of things that were put in at particular times, but which then become binding on future generations, and you build up a very elaborate scheme which will give you legal opinions on anything you care to name. You want to know what's the proper way to brush your teeth? You can find an Islamic scholar who will give you an opinion on that question, as will virtually any other human action that comes up. All right, so that's the way in which that was developed. And what it meant here was that the intellectuals, the scholars, the people who studied the texts, became essentially legal scholars for the most part. And when they developed this elaborate legal system, they began to shut aside other kinds of intellectual endeavors which could cause particular problems. Greek philosophy was flirted with for several centuries, and various aspects of that were brought in. But the concentration of the tradition, and again, I'm making generalizations, which I hope you'll realize are not to be cast in concrete, because there are exceptions to all the rules that I'm talking about, but I'm trying to give you an overall picture. But the tendency then in Islam became the question of orthopraxis rather than orthodoxy. The concentration was not on the development of theology and not on the development of ideas and beliefs, but how you behaved. That was going to be the determining factor in terms of whether you were following the path or not, and that could be more easily monitored. On the other hand, also, it was something in which if you wanted the community to maintain itself, you needed the enforcement mechanisms on practice. And so the ulama, or as I say, the scholarly community, tended to leave the state questions, make compromises, let me put it this way, compromises on the state questions as long as they were willing to enforce law and order, which meant Islamic law as a way of binding the community together. Now, let's get back to the leadership of the community and the state, because we're finally going to get to Shiism before we get out of here, I promise you. Who will guide the community? And I said there was no succession that had been, as far as anyone knows, given by Muhammad. Muhammad, one of the reasons that this became a problem is that, of course, Bedouin society, Arab society, was and is, if anybody who's been there knows, a very patriarchal society, very macho society. And if Muhammad had had a son who had lived to become an adult, it's very interesting to speculate what would have happened, but it would have been probably pretty difficult, unless the man were a complete fool, to have denied him the succession to Muhammad. But he didn't have a son, and that threw the whole question up for grabs. He had a daughter. He had a daughter who, in typical Bedouin fashion, had married his first cousin, his daughter Fatima, who had married his first cousin Ali. Some people believe that if anyone then had a hereditary right to the succession, it would have been Ali, his son-in-law, and his first cousin. But although the sources have become so colored by subsequent history that it's hard to sort things out, apparently Ali wasn't considered an automatic choice. He wasn't somebody who stood head and shoulders above everybody else, because he was passed over. Instead, the early Islamic community chose one of its members, a distinguished man named Abu Bakr, to be the Khalifa. That's usually Islamicized as the caliph, if you've heard that term. Now, the term means literally a deputy or a successor. But as we said, it wasn't a deputy or successor in a prophetic sense. It was simply as the head of the community, to administer the community. And one of the first things that this successor had to deal with was the question of unity again. Because many of the Bedouin tribes who had entered into this agreement with Muhammad felt that, after all, it was a contract, and when one of the parties in a contract dies, the contract is null and void, and they were off doing their own thing again. The other Muslim believers, though, said that when you made your Islam, and the word Islam means submission, you didn't make your submission to Muhammad, you made it to Allah. And that's not null and void. In fact, you are not allowed to back out on this now. And wars were fought then right after Muhammad's death, wars which are called the Wars of Apostasy, or the Ridha Wars, in which the Islamic community brought back into the fold those Bedouin clans and tribes who tried to get out. When that caliph died just 2 years later, he, before his death, had designated his successor, another highly respected Muslim within the community, a man named Omar, and he was generally acclaimed by the other Muslims as the proper successor. Omar is the one, in fact, who began to redirect the raiding impulse, which could no longer be conducted against fellow Bedouins, outward from Arabia. And when they started to raid the Byzantine Empire or Egypt or Iran, they found, in fact, that they could do more than raid. They could stay, because they were so much stronger and those empires were so much weaker than they had thought. And we talked about that expansion last time. But the point now is we're getting to a couple of different successions. Omar died. Actually, he was assassinated by one of his slaves over a personal grudge. But when he was succeeded, the method of selection for the third caliph was a different one again. Remember, the first one had just been generally elected by the community. The second one had been appointed by his successor. The third one now was chosen from a committee. A committee of six men were selected, and they were to choose one of those six to be the third caliph. The point is that you're not establishing any key precedent here. You're changing the precedent every time. The man that they chose happened to be a man of a very powerful, in fact, what used to be the most powerful clan in pre-Islamic Mecca, but yet not a particularly strong personality himself. From a strong family, but a weak person. Usually that's what happens when a committee is, you know, they've got six. Well, you know, I want to be it, and I want to be it, but, well, let's take him. You know, nobody will worry about him. The weakest of the lot is what the reputation is. May or may not be true, but he gets a lot of bad press because of what happened later on. So you don't know if he's being tarred with the brush of the loser in history or not. In any case, though, he wound up angering various aspects, various factions within the Islamic community. Some were angered about the distribution of loot from these now extremely successful expansionary campaigns. Some were unhappy because it was under this caliph that the authoritative version of the Quran was finally fixed. And, you know, when your version is rejected and somebody else's is put in, you don't necessarily feel real kindly to that person. And the third factor that got him into trouble was the fact that he had all these powerful relatives who he began to place in key posts, you know, all over this newly expanding empire. And again, this didn't look like a fair division of the spoils. In any case, some disgruntled people came back to Mecca, and this was, all these caliphs were simply first among equals among all believers. They didn't live in any kind of substantial house or have any of the trappings of royalty or any of that sort of thing. They just came up to this guy's house, and in an argument, they killed him. They assassinated him. But what to do? Now these guys are sitting here, we've killed the caliph, you know, there he is, now what do we do? Well, they turn to Ali. Ali, the son-in-law of Muhammad, the father of the Prophet's only grandsons, and said to Ali, you be the caliph. Ali said, okay, I will be. But now he's in a difficult situation. Naturally, the relatives of Uthman, the previous caliph, demand justice, demand that his murderers be brought forward and killed and executed, but these are the very people that put Ali into power. Even though he had nothing to do with the murder, he's still in a very delicate situation here. Some of his powerful relatives, which are stationed up there in Damascus and Syria and are mobilizing their troops, are saying, well, if you're not going to do something about this, we will. And they began to form an army. Ali got his army together, and soon these armies were on the verge of clashing. This is only some 30 years after the death of Muhammad. People looking across the battle, seeing this very incongruous situation, said, wait a minute, here we are, this Brotherhood of Islam, and we're about to kill each other. Something better has to take place. There should be some mediation, some arbitration here to settle this dispute. Ali agreed. We don't want to shed Muslim blood. Let's have arbitration. You can't please everybody when you're a political leader. In fact, some people were so outraged that Ali agreed to arbitration, some people within his own camp, that they seceded. They left his camp. These people were the first people who split off from Islam. They were called the Harajites, the people who seceded. And what their essential position was that God will certainly give the victor, will give to the victor the side that's right, clearly you must be right. And if you doubt that you're right in this, why are you agreeing to arbitration? You must be doubting it if you're agreeing to arbitration. You're trying to weasel out of this. Let's test it out. I mean, God's on our side. Right is here. You know, the people who are the true believers. And so Ali was suddenly devoid of a large portion of his force, and then how could he fight the battle? So he agreed to the arbitration. In fact, one of these men who seceded eventually then assassinated Ali within a couple of years. With the assassination of Ali, you got the family of the third caliph who took over, and who happened to have a very skillful leader, and he became once again the unified leader of Islam. But Ali had two sons, twin sons, Hassan and Hussein. And the people who believed that Ali was the rightful caliph, and in fact should have been the caliph from the beginning, encouraged these sons to carry on with their claims to the leadership. When, in about the year 682, his son Hussein made a bid to claim the leadership, he was surrounded with only a few followers at a place called Karbala in what is today Iraq. What is in fact the part of Iraq that is, right down here in the lower part of the Tigris-Euphrates valley down there. He was surrounded with his followers and cut to pieces, killed. Martyred became the word as far as the partisans of Hussein and Ali were concerned. In fact, they began to call themselves the Shia, Shia Ali, which means the word Shia means party or the partisans, and it just became a shortened form. It was actually the party of Ali initially, and later it just becomes the party of Ali. The point here is that the dispute, the split that is developing in Islam, is not a split, let's take like the Protestant Reformation, which was over more doctrinal questions than political ones, although certainly the authority of the Pope was called into question here. In Islam, it is a question of who has the right to lead the community. Who was the designated successor to the Prophet, and who should continue that leadership from then on. The majority view, claiming to follow the custom, remember that word sunnah, of the community, said that on the basis of what had happened to the first three caliphs, any good Muslim was theoretically eligible to lead the Islamic community. He could be elected from anyone who followed the proper code for conduct. This became the Sunni view, and these people are called Sunnis, and they make up today approximately 90% of all Muslims. Those, however, who believed that the true leadership of the community should have gone initially to Ali in the first place, and when it did go to Ali, then should continue in his line, because that would have been the genealogical descent from the Prophet as well, but particularly then from the line of Hussein, the martyred son of Ali, became the Shia. And so their claim to the community is that it's by blood and by genealogy and by descent. And they proclaim that the true leader of the community then is to be called the Imam. If you've heard that word, I-M-A-M, the Imam. Now, the disruptiveness of this first civil war among Muslims was so traumatic to the majority of the community that, as I said before, the ulama, the learned Islamic scholars, were willing to compromise almost anything so that that wouldn't happen again. And in particular, they became less and less concerned about the criteria or qualifications of the leader in terms of his Islamic conduct, and more on whether or not he was a strong enough man to maintain law and order within the society, so that, again, at least the Islamic law could be followed by the community and be reinforced through the courts and so forth. The height of this, in fact, comes, probably a quintessential example for this, comes when the Mongols invade the Islamic world in the 13th century, and the Mongols, who are pagans and heathen, take over much of the Islamic world, including all of Iran for a while, and you find Muslim ulama proclaiming that they should obey these new Mongol rulers because at least they can enforce law and order, even if they're not even Muslims. It's something that is worthwhile doing. Of course, they also know what's going to happen to them if they were to say something different, but it's interesting that they would even bother to work out theological justifications for doing it. Let's get back to the Shia. Well, with the Shia and the party of Ali, you have a alternative to whatever the prevailing government or prevailing leadership of the community is. If you don't like the way things are going, somebody is promising an alternative. Somebody is saying that if only we had the imam in power, if only the true leadership of the community were given where we rightfully belong, you say we have injustice, well, that's the reason why. You say that Islam isn't being followed correctly, this is the reason why. It's because we don't have the proper leadership. And so the Shias became a party that attracted dissidents from without the whole Islamic world, because your solution to your unhappiness had to be in part a political solution. And the Shia were providing an alternative to the established order, where, as I said, the majority of Muslim intellectuals tended to preach the status quo, tended to preach, obey the government, don't rock the boat. So a whole disparate group of people, for varieties of reasons, would occasionally latch in to the Shia cause. And certain interesting kinds of ideas then evolved among the Shia. Let me just mention a couple of them. The key concept, as I said, is the one of the imam, the rightly guided leader, who descended from Hussein. And because so much stress was put on the right leader, the parameters for his action were considerably enlarged as well. Instead of relying upon these hierarchies of authority that I mentioned, Quran, Hadith, Ijma, consensus of the community, for guiding the community, it was felt that the divinely guided leader, the imam, could make unilateral judgments about what the community ought to do. And therefore, if something needed new interpretation, it was possible to do it, because this imam was always divinely guided. In each generation, that divine guidance spread to each imam. You have later examples of certain Shia sects condoning or instituting practices which are in many cases wildly divergent from what Islam really preaches, but the justification is the imam has had the equivalent of almost like a new revelation. At least he knows to interpret this in a different way, and therefore it's justified. Whereas the Orthodox view, the Sunni view then of interpretation of the Quran, was very conservative and very careful, Shia imams could use the most esoteric kinds of interpretation of the Quran and get away with it because of the exalted status of the imam. Now, the problem with this kind of thing, in some ways then it makes you more flexible, makes you able to take in new challenges, new ideas, but the problem with this one is, sure, the imam has to be descended from Hussein, but after all, what happens if the imam has two or three sons? Which one of them is the right imam? Especially if two of them or three of them claim to be the imam. Well, just as in Christianity, that when with Luther you essentially say the individual believer is responsible for interpreting scripture on his own, and what happens to Protestantism, boom, you know, 1,001 sects, as people decide, I don't interpret it that way. With Shiism, what happens is with each passing generation, you raise the likelihood that there will be different offshoots of Shiism as people follow different imams. And that is precisely what happened. But Shiism, therefore, is much more complicated than a monolithic thing. There are three major divisions of Shiism today. And for simplicity's sake, I'll use the terms fivers, seveners, and twelvers. The reason for this is that the splits take place with the fifth imam in the fifth generation, in the seventh, and in the 12th. The other names aren't important to get at. But with the fivers, these are probably the most moderate Shiites. They believe that descendants of this alternate branch, the rest of the Shiites went one way, they took another brother at the fifth imam. Any of the descendants of this branch are okay as the imam, and that by this time is a lot of people. But they simply have to be elected by the community. So you're back to an election process, and they say the imam's guidance is not infallible. So it's a pretty moderate kind of system. These people exist in any substantial numbers only in the country of North Yemen today. That's where the fivers are. That's where the Shiites of that persuasion are. They're called the Zaydi ones. The seveners are, in many ways throughout Islamic history, one of the most interesting groups because they've had many other splits off of that. And by and large, through Islamic history, they've been the most radical. They have included ideas that virtually proclaim the imam a divine incarnation in certain cases. They've bordered on outright heresy as far as Islam is concerned in many particular respects, and have demanded then absolute allegiance to this divine-like imam in various forms and sects. Perhaps the most famous of these sevener sects was a group of those who lived in the mountains of Lebanon and Syria in the 12th and 13th century during the time of the Crusades. They were known as the Assassins. The word assassin, in fact, comes from the Hashashin, because allegedly the head of this sect would have his hired assassins smoke hashish and give them visions of the paradise that waited them of martyrdom when they would go out on the suicide missions and kill various officials. By the way, they weren't just after crusaders. In fact, more often than not, they were out killing other Muslim officials because they were, of course, of the wrong sect and did not follow the guidance of the imam. But there have been other groups as well. In fact, the one surviving sevener sect that you might know about is the sect led by the Aga Khan. Some of you have heard of him. It's moved over to what was Pakistan, Western India. And, of course, no longer has the kind of militancy or those aspects of it in this particular branch, but it has this almost divine obedience complete obedience to the Aga Khan as one of its key tenets. The third group, the Twelvers, are the group of Shiites that are the largest group today. What happened with the 12th imam was what can happen anytime you put all your hopes on a genealogical lineage. You could say that's what happened, but there are ways of getting around it. Well, what happened was that the son of the 11th imam disappeared as an infant. What to do? Well, what happened, this was in the 9th century, by the way, we're way back there. The doctrine built up called the occultation of the imam. The imam had not died, he was in hiding. Because after all, the Shiite were often persecuted throughout these first few centuries as being a subversive kind of group. He's in hiding, and he's coming back. You get a messianic aspect to Shiism. The Imam will reappear, and when he does, the Golden Age will be reinstituted, etc., etc. In the meantime, of course, you have to obey the Imam. Well, how do you obey the Imam? The Imam's not around. You have people who interpret the will of the Imam based on jurisprudence, etc., the same kinds of books, but a Shia set, though they don't differ very much doctrinally from those of the Sunni. But these figures, then, called mujtahids, people who interpret and give legal opinions that are in accordance with the will of the Imam, have proportionately, then, much more authority in Twelver Shiism than in the Sunni variety. Because in some ways they are giving pronouncements which can in fact be radically new and different if they have sufficient authority, which no one can controvert because, of course, this is the will of the hidden Imam, the one who's coming back. And this is the kind of Imamism that developed in Iran beginning in the 16th century and is the basis for what is going on in Iran today. Ayatollah Khomeini, who is one of these mujtahids, the one who had gotten eventually supreme authority, primarily just simply due to his reputation and charisma, not because he was passed any kind of test or made him elected at any kind of point, derives his authority from this kind of connection, or derived it that way. Now, tomorrow night, I'm going to talk about the Iranian Revolution. I guess we've set the stage for Shiism. The thing about Shiism, in terms of two or three concluding remarks, are that because Shiism then was a minority throughout most of its history of Islam, because it was often seen as a subversive threat to the established authority, and because the archetypal figure for Shiism itself was the Imam Hussein, who died a martyr to the faith against fighting against overwhelming odds, you have a series of themes here that builds itself up toward